This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You're listening to The West Wing Weekly. I'm Hrishikesh Hirway.
And I'm Joshua Molina.
Today we're talking about 18th and Potomac. It's season 2, episode 21, the penultimate episode of season 2.
It's very exciting. Before we begin, I'm going to have to ask for a password.
Fidelio?
No.
That was my least favorite part of Eyes Wide Shut. Sagittarius.
Sagittarius.
That is not my sign.
See, well, this is what I was thinking about. I don't know if you're an Outkast fan.
Not enough to get whatever you're working towards.
You know, they have a song called Aquemini from their album Aquemini. That's because the two of them, their astrological signs are Aquarius and Gemini.
Huh.
And so the song goes, nothing is for sure, nothing is for certain, nothing lasts forever, but until they close the curtain, it's him and I, Aquemini.
Nice. I was fishing for you to come up with what my sign is.
Ours would be...
Oh, you know my sign.
I'm saying, nothing is for sure, nothing is for certain, nothing lasts forever, but until they close the curtain, it's the two of us, Capricorius.
Nice. I like it. This actually, the repeated deployment of the password Sagittarius in this episode made me think of the fact that I worked on The West Wing for 4 seasons, and I had to do my own equivalent of that, which is to show picture ID every time I ever drove onto the lot. And I wanted to say, in fact, actually, I did say at Warner Brothers what I wanted the characters in West Wing to say, like, do you not recognize me? I've been working here for 4 years. Do I really have to take out my driver's license again? And I kind of felt like that too. It's like, I'm Josh Lyman. Can I get one in the room, please? All right, Sagittarius. But really? Come on.
Right.
Oh, that's quite a security system.
Yeah.
How about you tell the guy, Leo, CJ, Sam, Toby, and Josh are going to come in. Just don't let anyone else in.
Right. I do feel like you kind of blew past the fact that I had prepared Outkast lyrics with our astrological signs.
Yeah, I think it's catching up with me. I might be a little bit tired. I thought I was like, did he do that on the fly? Or why was that? Why was he so ready for that? And why does he know my... Okay, so you actually, that was your prep for the episode.
I think I had that in my back pocket from a while ago. I don't know why. Probably because I was just listening to Outkast one time and I was like, it's the two of us, Capricorns. Yeah.
You do astounding things and I take them for granted.
Astounding is a very nice way of saying totally f-ing dorky.
No.
Later on in this episode, once we stop yapping, we're going to be joined by Oliver Platt, who plays Oliver Babish.
I love Oliver. Both of them. Oliver's Platt and Babish.
Oliver's Platt. So let me hit you with the synopsis.
Please.
From TV Guide. With disastrous hypothetical polling numbers from Joey Lucas in hand, staffers prepare to announce the president's condition. But first, both Sam and Oliver Babish question the first lady about the matter. Meanwhile, a crisis erupts in Haiti. Josh deals with two Democratic senators who are less than enthusiastic about the government's tobacco industry suit, and male staffers can't help but give Mrs. Landingham car buying advice. I wanted to let the listeners in on a little peek behind the scenes of our process. We tried to record this episode last night and utterly failed.
That's true. It's the only time ever, I think, that we just didn't get traction.
We were both exhausted. And I think we were a little bit at a loss for what to say. And I have a theory as to why that is.
But first, can I say also that during that conversation, I pulled a Carol and I told you that you looked tired.
Yeah, that's right. I was like,
that's what you're saying to me?
We actually had that moment.
Yeah, it's true. I was like, oh, I said, how are you? You said tired. I said, yeah, me too. You said, yeah, you look tired.
Even as I said, I was like, I've learned nothing from this show.
Exactly.
Hit me with your theory.
Okay, well, I think it's pretty hard to talk about this episode, everything that happens in the first 40 minutes, when the episode ends with the death of Mrs. Landingham. In the actual episode itself, the last 2 minutes of the show, there's no dialogue.
Is that right?
Yeah, Charlie says,
"No, she's dead."
And from then until the last 2 minutes of the episode, there's just no speaking. It's just Leo taking it in and then having to go and tell the president. It's probably one of the longest, if not the longest stretch of a West Wing episode with no dialogue.
I'm sure you're right. Shall we try that with this episode of our podcast? Well, it might not play as well without the visual element.
Right. But I'm looking at you through streaky glass as we talk.
There you go.
But it like highlighted, when I watched again today, it reinforced, I think, why I had such a hard time yesterday, which is that like it's too much. It's like too big and too sad of a plot point to then kind of riff on, I don't know, about the jokes about the tow package. Did you know what was going to happen in this episode? Did you remember from the first time when you watched how this episode was going to end?
Yes, I knew that Mrs. Landingham would die in this episode. I didn't really remember the details of how. I remembered it as I watched it, but I didn't start it with the full knowledge of how it would unspool.
Right. Yeah, it was a real sucker punch.
Yeah, it is. It's an absolute punch to the gut. Yeah.
You've already got so much on the plates of the staffers. It's like as if the MS stuff isn't enough and the reelection stuff, then there's this whole debacle in Haiti. And normally that would be enough for an episode. You know, you've got your domestic political crises and then you have like an international subplot that happens off screen but is important and somehow plays into things. And then they sneak in this move that just, it puts the whole thing into context a little bit. Even though we don't get into it, like we don't get to discuss the ramifications of her getting killed in this episode, it changes the tenor of everything that you saw leading up to it.
Yes, that is true. Yeah, I thought a lot of, there's a lot of things of micro and macro importance happening in this episode.
Yeah.
And affecting each other. Also, let me just say.
Yeah.
That the teleplay is by Aaron Sorkin.
Oh my gosh, I totally skipped all this stuff.
The teleplay is by Aaron Sorkin. The story by Lawrence O'Donnell. This episode was directed beautifully by Bob Berlinger, and it first aired on May 9th in the year 2001.
He's credited in the episode as Robert Berlinger.
Yes, I just...
But you know him as Bob Berlinger.
Yes.
You're on De Niro terms with him.
Perhaps it's overly intimate, and he would balk at my use, but yes, Bob Berlinger.
I always wanted that. I always wanted to get to that point where I, you know, everybody calls Robert De Niro Bobby.
Yeah. How's that going? Have you made any progress?
Oh, I only call him Bobby.
Ah.
I've never met him.
I see.
But
well, there you go. You just jumped
but
right
mission
to
accomplished.
It. Look at you making your dreams come true.
Yeah.
If you'd like, you can call me Bobby.
Someone that we spoke to once referred to Martin Sheen as Marty, and I thought that was awesome.
And who was that?
I think it was it Lawrence O'Donnell?
Larry? Might have been.
I don't know if people know that I call you Joshy, but only because you first called yourself Joshy to me.
We're way past that. You've now publicly called me Hot Pants. So, Joshy's, it's really meaningless at this point.
Yeah. I liked it because I felt like you were relating yourself to me when you left that in a voicemail. You said, Rishi, it's Joshy.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. This episode. Should we start at the beginning?
Why not? For a change.
The cold open starts in the basement and the staff is meeting with Joey Lucas to go over the numbers.
These numbers aren't going to mean anything, right? With the hypothetical and lack of context, plus the pre-existing level of trust.
Yeah.
I'm saying he's got numbers like Walter Cronkite.
Yeah.
Is there anything in there that we're going to like?
We are, in fact, eating more beets.
I'm glad that people appreciated the, at least some people, appreciated the beets, beads, bees reference.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can't watch any of these episodes without thinking of it. And then the president asks, I always wondered if people are going to know the answer now. The president asks,
giving their governor a hypothetical concealed...
Excuse me. How many people in this room know Kenny's last name?
And I wondered how many of our listeners shouted, it's Thurman.
I didn't.
Did you think, that's a good question?
Yeah, I think I was more in that camp.
When we did the West Wing trivia night outside the DNC.
That was one of the questions?
One of the questions was, what's Kenny's last name? I felt good about that one.
Yeah, I don't think my knowledge base for future West Wing trivia is improving. I mean, certainly it's better than it was a year ago, but not impressively so. Things aren't sticking.
I bet that's not true. I think you probably retain more than you give yourself credit for.
Maybe. I sometimes look through as I go to get the air date and the credits for an episode. My eye takes in other episodes' titles, and very rarely does an episode title mean anything to me in terms of what happens in that episode. There's certain ones, like, you know, 18th and Potomac. I always remember that's the intersection. There's certain giveaways, Take the Sabbath Day, but most of them couldn't tell you.
Do you want to do a quick little lightning round right here?
Well, you're bring it.
Sorry, Mark, we've run out of time, but we'll pick it up with our lightning round tomorrow.
So here's our lightning round.
Okay.
All right, this is just off the dome for both of us. We'll start with this episode. What is the name of the democratically elected president of Haiti who's been deposed?
Dessalines.
Yeah, see, you're off and running.
Go ahead, hit me with your second question. I'm on a huge roll.
You're on a roll.
I could just quit now as the undefeated champion of the West Wing Weekly trivia quiz.
I'm going to go further back because I know where this is going to be trouble for you. What is Leo's ex-wife's name?
Thurman.
Correct. That's amazing. That is amazing.
Marilyn, Stacy, Joshy, Bob.
You're close in that all of those are names.
That's all I've got. Multiple choice?
Sure. Is it Ellie? Is it Jenny? Is it Joey?
Jenny. It's Jenny. I remember.
It is Jenny.
Okay. So I'm one for two.
Okay. One more for good measure?
Sure.
Okay. What state is Donna from?
Is I don't care an acceptable answer?
It is. You are right. That's two out of three. That's pretty
what
good.
What state is she from? She's from Wisconsin.
Hey, you're right. Exactly.
Is that true?
That's true.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
I know.
See,
this show.
Like I said, you retain more than you
Much
think.
Much better than I thought.
Yeah.
I know two out of three things about this show.
Jenny McGarry is pretty far back. Anyway, so the president asks if anybody knows Kenny's last name. Nobody answers, which is a little bit surprising.
And that is a should we trust this guy moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is actually something that you talked about one time when the president says,
I believe this operation is no longer covert.
Because you were saying how, like, you know, they said 17 people, but then they didn't include Charlie.
Right.
There's already leaks sprung between this, the idea of this information staying secret is pretty faulty.
Right. I think we're seeing something like that play out now in the headlines.
Right. Yeah.
Currently, I think keeping a lid on things in a situation like this is not easy.
I mean, they have no idea if any of the doctors might have said anything. I mean, you'd like to think that they observe doctor-patient confidentiality or whatever, but somebody might say something to their wife. Who knows? And so then we get to Joey's poll numbers, and they are pretty rough.
1,170 registered voters in Michigan were polled, giving their governor a hypothetical concealed degenerative illness. These are the results. Do you agree that it's okay for the governor to lie about his health? 17% agree, 83% disagree. Would you be as likely or less likely to vote for the governor now that you know he has a degenerative illness? 71% say less likely. The largest block of likely voters are women over 55. 78% of those women say they wouldn't vote for a candidate with MS.
We just lost Florida.
But here's something that is interesting. So did we do when this episode aired?
Yes. May 2001.
So in October of 2001, there was an actual poll that was done that was remarkably similar to this poll.
Really?
And I don't know if it's because of the West Wing, but the actual results were actually much more positive. Here's just some top level numbers. 92% of Americans at the time were aware of MS. And almost half of them, 48%, who were aware of MS, believed that the disease would have little to no effect on decision-making abilities. 48% of those aware of MS believed that MS medications are effective. But 77%, here's the big number, 77% of people who were aware of MS would remain confident in a leader's ability to perform his or her job duties despite the disease.
Those questions, though, to me, sound a little bit more nuanced than the ones that Joey's rattling off. You know, it was about the deception that the president had perpetrated.
Do you think it's okay for the governor to lie about his health?
Right. And again, reverberations with what's going on now. Even if I am not so concerned about the thing you lied about, the fact that you lied about it is its own issue.
Yeah. And on our next episode, we're going to be speaking to author Mary Graham. She's the author of President's Secrets, The Use and Abuse of Hidden Power. And we're going to get to talk to her a little bit about the ramifications of presidents concealing their health in real life examples of that in history and compare it to what's happening in the show.
That should be very enlightening.
So the cold open ends on this really nice, cheery note.
Joey, is there any good news in there at all?
No, sir.
And then we catch the music and we're like, oh, great.
Ta-da.
Bum, bum, bum. So once they've set the tone with the A plot there, and then we get right into the B plot, which is the Haiti plot. And again, it's just like total shit show.
Yeah. I saw a little bit of that situation as a metaphor somehow for Bartlett's and for, you know, Dessalines and a car trunk being snuck in, you know, through a gate.
Yeah.
And I just kind of felt like it was a little bit of a, I don't know if I can draw the exact parallel, but Bartlett sort of throwing a lifeline to another leader who's just hanging on by a thread.
Yeah.
And when he says, you know, it's a tough decision, and it's laid out pro and con, the ramifications of his saying, let him through. And
right.
I just think Bartlett at that moment is empathizing and identifying right. with the guy in the trunk. I think Bartlett sees himself as the valid and deserved leader of a country who is being assailed from all sides.
I thought it was maybe like the like President Bartlett was doing some kind of karmic penance that, like, if he can save this guy and his presidency, then maybe he might be able to make up for his own presidency.
Okay, I buy it.
After that, we get into this sort of strategy session that's happening still down in the basement, or as I like to call it, La Casa de las Sagittarias.
Very nice. Yeah, I like what's going on in that room because our heroes are fighting, and I like when they don't get along, and CJ and Sam are snapping at each other.
With the first lady.
Some decorative room. Sitting with his wife weakens him. Let's put him behind the Kennedy desk. Let's put him in the East Room. Let's put him in the
Sam,
briefing room.
Sam, he's going to go on TV and say he lied. I don't want him doing it behind the seal of the president.
I enjoy that fractured group dynamic that we rarely but sometimes get.
Yeah.
And the stakes are high.
Yeah, it feels like they're kind of nasty to each other. It doesn't feel like a well-oiled machine on any level.
Right.
It's interesting, too. I think that they've done a good job of carrying through the plot that the people who have found out later about the MS are dealing with it less well. CJ and Sam are kind of at each other's throats, and they seem to be a little bit more on edge, whereas Toby seems a little bit more like exhausted and resigned.
Well, he was the first, though.
And he was the first.
He flipped, but he flipped badly.
Exactly. I mean,
even somewhere in there, he kind of, in a self-deprecating way, gives the kudos to Donna for how well
right.
she took it.
How'd she take it? Everybody out there takes it the way she did, we may be okay. A few more people in here took it the way she did. That'd be all right, too.
Was that for me?
That was for me.
I love that exchange.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I was thinking, like, both of them, Toby and Josh are the first two people, Leo, Toby, and Josh, these are the first people to know. Sam and CJ find out later, and of the senior staff, they're still, it feels like they're still processing.
It's fresh.
Still angry, yeah, about it.
Yeah, it's raw. That's correct.
Yeah.
I did notice also, we talked, I think, last episode about how Joey responded when she got the news and how she,
yeah.
You know, pretty quickly asked about how the president was feeling and how he was doing. And
yeah.
Donna does a similar thing.
Is the president in a lot of pain or discomfort right now?
I don't know if it's a female thing or a maternal thing, or I certainly noticed that both the two of them were the ones who immediately reacted with concern for the president himself and how he was doing. And then, you know, Donna showed that first worry and then immediately kind of snapped to and got back to work.
Yeah. Maybe it is a maternal thing because they're both people who are potentially romantically involved with Josh Lyman, who needs a mom.
Ha, there you go. Why did Toby tell Donna?
Well, this is what I thought was neat. I felt like this was kind of a carryover a little bit from the previous episode when Leo, he started to talk to Abby before the president could.
Right, which tweaked the president.
How could you tell Abby about the health form before I did?
I didn't know you hadn't told her. you know, there was a strange kind of thing about like the bounds of marriage and what an outsider can do or say. And I felt like a similar thing was being explored here. Even though Josh and Donna aren't married, let's face it, they basically are.
Right, they're TV married. It was a similar dynamic. And Josh gets tweaked.
You told Donna. Yeah, why don't you let me?
You hadn't yet.
It felt like a strange violation of boundaries or something, to Josh at least.
Right, but I didn't even in the moment, why did somebody need to tell Donna? So that she could bring them donuts and coffee in the basement room or something? Like, I didn't quite see what part of the puzzle she, what, you know, in terms of the need to know clearance, I'm not sure why Donna needed to know.
Well, you know, Toby's explanation is this is what Josh is going to be working on 24 hours and he's going to need your help and he's going to need you to know. And so I'm telling you. And I think somehow Toby sensed that Josh might drag his feet about it, because even later as they get into it and Donna has to reveal that she knows about Sagittarius, which I thought was quite a silly way of revealing it, by the way. But even in that point, you know, he's still covering. He's like, oh, you know what that is. And so Toby's right. He's like, he's going to be more effective at his job if she can help him. But the only way she can help him is if she's on the inside.
Eh. I don't know if I buy that, but okay.
But she is, you know, the blankets is maybe like a minor thing relative to the big picture, but it's also, you know, a crucial thing and shows like she's anticipating needs and realizing what they, she's doing a good job because she knows that people are going to be down there 24/7.
Oh, is that what she brings them?
There's an empty office next to the conference room downstairs. I moved two couches in and there's some pillows and blankets.
See, I didn't remember. I can't even get that trivia question. I made up coffee and donuts.
No, yeah.
How about this? Instead of Toby telling her this top secret piece of information, he says, hey, can you grab a couple blankets and bring them to this room? I can't tell you why, because it's f-ing top secret. But just right. Grab a blanket and bring it there. That also would have worked.
But...
No, but then you wouldn't get a couple good interchanges in this episode. Don't get me wrong.
I think she would need to know. She's going to need to know something, you know, because he's going to be, he needs to.
She needs to know that you have to grab a couple blankets and bring them.
Otherwise, Josh is working on the tobacco lawsuit.
Yes, I did notice in the tobacco subplot, we have Ritter, Senator Ritter, played by John Rubenstein. I thought this was a lovely little bit of happenstance, if that's English. John Rubenstein starred in the original Broadway production of Children of a Lesser God, premiered on Broadway in 1980. I was there opening night because dear friend of the family, Manny Eisenberg, produced it.
And you're a big Bill Hurt fan.
And I'm a big Bill Hurt. Bobby. Billy.
Bobby.
right. And of course, Marley Matlin won an Oscar for the 1986 film version of that play.
Right. She was not in the 1980 version on Broadway, as she would have been 13 years old.
That is correct. Phyllis Frelich played the role, and she was wonderful. And I was 1980. I was 14, and it was a very impactful performance and incredible play.
Was that your first time seeing something on Broadway?
No. I was very lucky because my parents were big fans of the theater, and also because my dad's best friend was this big Broadway producer. I was very, very lucky and got to see a lot of theater in New York. Hmm.
That's awesome.
What was your first Broadway play? Mine was, I can't quite remember, it was either Pippin, it's a musical, I can tell you about that later, or The Magic Show starring Doug Henning. I forget which one of those I saw first, but those were one and two for me.
Hmm. Well, I think you know my first Broadway.
In addition to being at West Wing trivia, I'm not that good at Rishi trivia. What, we've had this conversation before?
Yes.
Or can you, is there a way you can give me a hint? What year was it?
It was 2016.
Wait a minute. What are you talking about?
First time I ever saw anything on Broadway was...
Was Hamilton?
Yes.
Are you kidding me?
No.
What the hell? Oh my God. Oh dear Lord.
I played a show with my band once at Town Hall, which I think, is that considered Broadway? No, it's just a venue near Broadway.
Yeah, that's true. Wow, it's amazing.
But my first being in the audience of a Broadway play was Hamilton in 2016.
There's another great theater actor in this episode.
Okay.
Peter Michael Goetz plays Paul Hackett.
Oh, the NBC executive.
Yes, exactly. CJ negotiates the interview without telling him at all what's going to be discussed. And terrific theater actor. and played the dad in Brighton Beach Memoirs, the Neil Simon play. Went to opening night of that in 1983. Matthew Broderick, Peter Michael Goetz, incredible cast. And I just love seeing these tremendous theater actors pop up in small roles in the West Wing.
Yeah, that was a nice, again, a nice little piece of network synergy there. You know that they're going to do it with Dateline. We talked about how they had Jay Leno on in the
right
in the office outside the executive assistant office, and now they're like, it's going to be Dateline. They get to mention all kinds of NBC stuff in there, and I thought, oh, that's a good way to suck up to your bosses.
Yeah, it was almost too much, but that's when Friends is on. We'll preempt it.
Wait, did they? Is that? Oh, okay.
I wanted him to mention like all the other shows that are on NBC.
That's right. Yeah. CJ's the person who has to understand the needs of the networks.
Right.
Which makes sense as the press secretary, but it is a little bit crazy that Sam can't see past his own outrage.
Sweeps. There's a damn about May Sweeps.
They do, Sam.
Right. Yes.
It reminded me a little bit of a moment in Lies, Damn Lies and Statistics.
I recognize that as the title of a West Wing episode.
That's right.
3 for 4 now.
And in that one, they're arguing about...
What's your problem?
When making policy decisions, do you think that President Bartlett puts the needs of average people first? Average people's a pejorative phrase that occurs about 6 times in the polling model.
This may come as a shock.
Oh, right. I do remember. It's a walk and talk.
Yeah, exactly.
4 for 5.
And CJ says...
CJ, played by Alice and Jenny. 5 for 6.
This is a new interesting model of our show. But CJ says, she again kind of undercuts that, and she's like, you know, most people actually like the phrase average American. It's comforting to them. It's only head snobs like you that are
right
upset by it. Anyway, I thought I got a similar vibe from that line that she says to Sam.
How about the Abby Sam scene? That was another, I feel like this is a pairing we've maybe never seen before.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. And am I wrong or underneath this whole sort of little bit of a cat and mouse thing?
Why aren't the president and I doing this together?
I'm sorry.
Somebody's doing this with the president, and I was asking why we're not doing it at the same time. Is it so you can compare our stories?
Yes.
But underneath it all, I also felt like she might want to throw him on the table and take him right there. There's a little bit something. She gives him a look. There's a little bit of a potential cougar moment happening in this. Jeez. Am I making that up? Am I wrong?
See it, but I'm not saying you're wrong, but I didn't see it.
Oh, okay.
The part in that scene that always kind of catches my ear is when Sam takes a beat and then he says, yes. Like he says it with a kind of vehemence or something that like betrays some kind of anger or like frustration.
I do know the moment, and I think you're absolutely right that there is something there, and I think it's, of course that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more of a Babish thing. We're like, yes, right. In order to protect you, these are the things we need to do, because somebody on the other end is going to pick apart your stories, and if they're not the same, and if we don't find where they differ and kind of hammer that out, there's going to be trouble.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it was loaded in that one little syllable.
I think it was neat how much you could see the difference between Sam's dynamic with the First Lady, because you get to contrast it with Oliver Babish's scene with her. And it's in the same setting. It's a very similar kind of setup, but Sam is like, except for that one moment, he's like kind of trying to keep his frustration in check and being deferential. But I love that Babish just doesn't really have time for any of that.
Yeah, that's right. In Oliver's performance and in Oliver Babish's approach to these scenes where he's questioning, I feel like the unspoken message is, I'm not the one who's in trouble here. Like, there's no risk to me. If you don't want to do this, you want to be difficult about it, but you understand it's your ass that's out there. I think Sam feels really identified and, you know, and at some risk himself and drawn into it. And Babish has sort of a very important and palpable remove from the danger of it all.
Right. My favorite part in that exchange, though, is at the end, when he ends the conversation by calling her Dr. Bartlett.
Is there anything else?
No. Thank you, Dr. Bartlett.
He's so sharp. He's like able to stay on his game, do everything that he needs to do, but in the essentially letter of the law kind of way, he takes in the information that she gives him and he digests it and then is able to use it.
Yeah, that's
and he
right.
calls her Dr. Bartlett. He doesn't do it in a deferential way or even in a very nice way, but he is doing what she asks, which is she wants to be called Dr. Bartlett.
That's right.
This is one of those moments where we had a conversation about Mrs. Bartlett versus Dr. Bartlett ages ago on our podcast, and everybody was like, this all gets cleared up in season 2, episode 20, you know, and we had to be like, yes, we know, but we're not going to talk about that until it happens. So finally it's happened and we can actually talk about it.
Do you think that I knew it was coming and I was like, hey, we can't talk about it now? Or do you think I didn't know what was being discussed?
You were like 18th of Potomac, 6 for 7.
Exactly. Bam. Bring it.
It makes me wish that the first lady was in every episode though.
She's fantastic. She always lights the place on fire.
Yeah.
So Mrs. Landingham dies.
Here's something that happened because of this episode. This is actually real. This really happened. The California Assembly had a moment of silence for Mrs. Landingham after the episode.
No way.
Yeah.
That's indefensible. Well, you know, what's interesting, I will say this about the moment, is that the first time I watched this episode was 16 years ago. And Catherine Justin was alive. And so rewatching it, knowing that this wonderful actress, in fact, had passed away, made it land with in a more significant way, I think. Even, I mean, it always was a great episode and a great, very impactful moment. But something about knowing that the actress herself is dead.
Yeah.
Gave it a sort of really more deeply melancholy feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. That must be hard for anybody who knew her to watch this episode.
Yes.
Even though it's obvious, it's not her, it's a fictional character.
Right, yeah, no, I would think so.
I was reading interviews with her that she did after the episode aired and everybody found out, and you know, and it seemed like she was taking it in good spirits. Here's a little background from Aaron. This is from an article from July of 2001. Sorkin said the response has been amazing, as if a real person had died. The worst part of killing Mrs. Landingham was losing Catherine from our cast, he said. He recalled that the idea to kill the character came to him when the cast attended a charity banquet and he and Catherine Justin went outside for a cigarette. She happened to mention, this is a quote from Aaron, she happened to mention that she was going out for a pilot and I didn't hear a thing she said because I started thinking about what it would be like if she left us, he said. Then I kept thinking about it, and I saw Mrs. Landingham's death as a way to take the president right to the edge.
Hmm.
Now the joke around set is, don't take a smoke break with Aaron.
And certainly don't discuss other projects you're pursuing with your current boss.
I guess that's just good advice for
everybody. Which I've always just intuited naturally as an actor. But I guess she learned that the hard way.
But yeah, I mean, it goes along with everything that you said about how Aaron Sorkin pulls ideas for stories and plots and pieces of dialogue from everything around him. He's just like constantly absorbing information, pulling it in, and then churning it out into stuff that makes it into episodes.
That's right.
It makes it crazy because it's such a huge, huge moment in the show. What would have happened if she just didn't mention it?
Yeah, maybe Charlie would have died.
And it would have been your favorite episode.
Yeah, that's how it.
People, we haven't talked about this on the podcast, but this is a thing that you've, a running joke that you've had when people have asked what your favorite episode of The West Wing is.
I always respond, the one where Charlie died.
Right.
Spoiler alert.
Season 6, spoiler alert.
Wow, that's really mean. That seems so unlike you, but I like it. Did she go on very quickly, Catherine Justin, to Desperate Housewives?
Let's see. That was 2004, so not that quickly. She would go on to Desperate Housewives when that show started up. But my favorite post-West Wing thing that she did was an appearance in Gilmore Girls in one of my favorite moments of one of my favorite episodes of that series, where Luke and Lorelai have their first date at her restaurant that is Luke's favorite place. And it's a great, wonderful scene. And when she shows up in that role, it's perfect. Shout out to any Gilmore Girls West Wing crossover listeners.
I'm reading here, Tish. Catherine started acting or became a professional actor at 42, having been a psychiatric nurse prior to that.
And she only moved to Hollywood, I think, in her mid-50s.
And she won 2 Emmys for her work on Desperate Housewives. How about that?
Wow. Yeah.
It's worth noting that Catherine Joosten was a governor of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences.
Part of the reason why this episode is hard to talk about, I think, is because it's essentially a continuation of, it's like a bridge episode.
That's true.
I mean, like, the death of Mrs. Landingham is this huge event, but it only happens at the very end, and it's only covered in this one phone call that we don't actually hear. It's just this one bit of dialogue between Charlie and Leo. Everything else that happens is really, it's just furthering, you know, the Haiti plot was a continuation. The MS is, of course, a continuation from Five Arcs. Even the tobacco subplot, which I thought in the last episode was handled so nicely and had this, you know, wonderful resonance of the fraud that's being perpetrated. Here, even that continues. And I was almost, you know, I know where it goes, but I was surprised to be like, oh yeah, this is still a thing that's going. It felt nice because it was realistic in that these single issue,
these things don't resolve and go away or disappear. Exactly. They still sort of thorny daily elements played out against greater crises happening.
Yeah, like single issue voters, we have single issue episodes.
Right.
But yeah, here it actually continued. But it was a little bit jarring. I was like, oh, this is, it almost felt like it was being dragged out or something just by virtue of getting some more information about this one story. So really, I think it's kind of hard to talk about because there's not, it's hard to talk about in a new way from everything that we talked about in the last episode and the episode before that and the episode before that. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Oliver Platt. And now back to the show.
Now, Rishi and I are delighted to welcome to the show a multi-Emmy nominee, a Golden Globe nominee, an Independent Spirit Award winner. He's a star of stage and screen, my friend, Oliver Platt.
Hey, Josh, how are you, buddy?
Hey, Oliver. Oh, it's nice to hear your voice.
Nice talking to you. Of course, I've been listening to your voice and yours, Rishi, all afternoon. I just started with this afternoon with the one that you guys, I guess it was the last one you posted, the one we had a long talk with Richard.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. The detail. It's incredible. Like, am I wrong, or is the podcast actually longer than the episode?
Oh, definitely. Every time.
Really?
That's fantastic. For sure.
I was freaking riveted. Anyway, I'm delighted to talk to you guys.
Thanks, Oliver. You know, I was reminiscing with Rishi in your first appearance. I have been a fan of yours since 1988 and your appearance in The Miser at Yale Rep.
Well, dude, I have the best story about almost not doing this. I was in Canada, I think it was 2001. Everybody was very concerned about a looming writer's strike that people were worried was going to really shut the business down. And I was, like a lot of people up in Canada, I was doing a strike movie, which, you know, in other words, just maybe not the, it was just like people think you got to work because you got to put money in the bank. And I remember I got a call from my then manager, and he said, you know, Aaron Sorkin wants you to come and be on the West Wing. And I had literally just had my own TV show. When I say a TV show that had actually been sort of built around me, ripped unceremoniously off the air after three episodes. And so I was like, television, you know, NBC, I knew how good The West Wing was because I'd seen it, but I'd seen a couple episodes. I knew Aaron because Aaron wrote the first draft of a movie that I did with a young actor named Josh Molina called Bulwark. He had asked me personally to read this and wanted to talk to me about it. And the only reason I read it is because I wanted to call Aaron, and I was totally going to pass. But, you know, I wanted to show him the respect that he deserved. And again, I was flattered to be asked. But then, of course, I read it. And that actor thing took over, you know, and it was like, well, I'm not going to watch somebody else do this. You know what I mean? And I told Aaron exactly that. And I had no idea that I was, you know, about to go and work on sort of a historically fantastic television narrative. I learned more about how to make television in, it was really only 8 visits, I think, but I learned just a tremendous amount about how good television is made, you know.
Let me go back for a second and get the chronology right. So I didn't realize that Aaron Sorkin had done a draft of Bulworth. I had no idea.
Not a lot of people know that, but it's a matter of record. I mean, it's my understanding anyway, the first draft of Bulworth with Warren.
Josh, did you know about that? Is that all related to how you guys got the
yeah,
parts?
Yeah, no, I know that he was in the mix and working with Warren for a long time, and I know that I also got Bulworth once again, if not directly through Aaron, then certainly indirectly, because we did a reading of a play of Aaron's called Making Movies, which is a two-act version of a one-act he wrote called Hidden in This Picture, and he invited Warren Beatty and Annette Bening, and Gary Shandling was there too. Aaron got me a lot of work. Even when he didn't directly write the project, he put me in front of the right people. So that led me to Bulworth doing that little play reading and to working with Oliver.
It's funny that your first experience seeing Oliver in something was at the Yale Rep. My first experience of becoming a fan of both of you guys as actors was when I saw Bulworth at Yale. And I think, Oliver, I'd seen you in stuff before, but that was really the first movie where I was like, wow, this guy, I really dig. And Josh, that was the first thing I'd ever seen you in. And that was also at Yale.
Look at that. Look at that Yale.
Look at that. But I will tell you this, that scene, you know, Josh and I had a bunch of fun stuff to do at Bulworth, but that substance abuse scene in the closet.
I've had other offers, you know, plenty. I beat him up with a stick. Didn't he have it all, though, Bill? Didn't he have it all? Looks, brains more or less enough, classy wife. But Jesus Christ, Bill, for God's sake, he had us. The mother had us.
That remains sort of one of the favorite scenes that I've ever put on film in any medium.
That makes my day to hear, because it's certainly on my highlight reel, which is a lot shorter than yours. So that for it to be on yours is really something and very flattering.
Quality over quantity, Melina. Quality over quantity. That's your Melina.
I suppose. What was the short-lived Oliver Platt series?
That was Deadline, right?
That time?
Yeah, Deadline.
I remember that.
Not every show comes relatively fully formed out into the world, much like The West Wing did. To go from a, you know, an environment where you had people who were learning how to work together and really trying to find a show to one that was humming on all cylinders. I mean, for instance, when I came in for the first episode, flew me in on a Sunday afternoon. They drove me to Aaron's bungalow. Aaron and I got in his golf cart and drove to the set. And we walked into the mural room, and there was Marty, John, Tommy Salami, practically the entire cast, you know, arrayed around. I'm like, this is on a Sunday night. And I was going, oh, it's like, this is how hard you work. You need to work when, you know, anyway, we never were doing Sunday night rehearsals on that other show, I'll tell you that.
So that was for your first rehearsal for the episode? You already had the part at that point?
Oh, yeah. Aaron offered it to me. You know, again, the call that I got in Canada was when I found out that he wanted me to do it. And this was the next day, the Monday, we were shooting something like, you know, freaking 11 pages of dialogue. And very kindly, they wanted to do a rehearsal. I was thrilled.
So would that have been your first big scene with John and Martin?
Yes, and let me tell you something, you know, talk about a writer who knows how to write an introduction for a character. You know, that was the hammer scene.
Would you like us to pack your big hammer?
Okay, you know what? Don't make fun of the big hammer. Big hammer happens to be a gavel given to my father's father by Justice Louis Brandeis. I need a dictaphone.
You've got one on your desk.
Doesn't work.
What's wrong with it?
Doesn't work.
He's asking.
It's stuck on record. It won't stop recording things, so it's just what you want lying around the White House counsel's office, because there's never been a problem with that before.
This particular rehearsal and the experience of doing the first episode, that when I finally talked to Aaron from wherever I was in Vancouver, I told him the story. He goes, oh, great. I'll never forget. He said, just come and make it your own. I really want you to make it your own. We have to understand, I was coming more from a little bit from the movie world where scripts are a lot more fluid. You know what I mean? And so I remember flying on the plane. I was like, you know, sort of crossing stuff out and going, I'll probably say this instead. we get to this rehearsal. Okay, and where everybody's arrayed around this table. And, you know, Aaron is just very kindly introducing me, and then he's leaving. But just before he leaves, Marty, who I'm sitting next to, raises his hand to stop Aaron from going out the door. He said, and he was very clear, he had a question about the script. And Aaron walks slowly back around, looks over his shoulder, and Martin literally says, you know, I really think that this is, and I'm not exaggerating here, I think this is a but, not an and. And Aaron looked down at the page, and it seemed like it was probably only for about 15 seconds, but it felt like an hour. And then he finally said, well, let me think about that. And he slowly walked out. And you can imagine my freaking blood froze, because I had 11 pages of dialogue the next day that I had sort of like very loosely committed to memory. And so, you know, it was sort of poetic justice that my character was supposed to be incredibly tired in that first scene, having stayed up all night, because in fact, I had.
And oh my God, that's hilarious.
And I know, Josh, when you got there, was there still this lovely Irish woman named Hillary, who was not the script supervisor, whose only job was to, you know, mince after you after your previous take and very politely, in a lilting Scottish voice, point out all the things you got wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. The funniest part about that story is that he set you up. Make it your own.
Well, I can't believe he was consciously doing that, but he certainly did. You know what I mean? And the other thing, the great thing about it was, though, that, you know, I actually happened to know a lot of the members of the cast. Allison was quite a close friend of mine. I knew Bradley. I knew Richard from New York. They knew the hell that I was going through, right? And they were sort of like, they all had these sort of like, you know, slightly sadistic but affectionate smiles on their faces, like, yeah, man, we've been there. Ooh, boy. But let me tell you, it was such an incredible blessing. Like, John and Marty were so kind, you know what I mean? And so understanding and so helpful and so welcoming. And I'm telling you, it meant a huge amount to me, because it was very disorienting, because I just wasn't used to sort of, you know, I had worked that way for a while.
It's funny, because I remember the opposite when working on Bullworth. I remember walking to the set one day with Warren, and he said, so what do you want to say? And I was like, what are you talking, what do you mean?
Exactly. That's the world that I was coming from, you know?
Yeah. He was like, well, what do you want to say in this scene? I was like, what's written? He said, no, we'll do that too, but think about what you want to say. I'm not used to that. Coming up in the Sorkin world, I wasn't used to that.
I made the mistake of unconsciously conflating Aaron with that experience. And so
there you go. And in fairness, he did tell you to make it your own. I like that your name is Oliver in the role, by the way, because while you lose yourself into roles and you have a huge range, there's also something quintessentially Oliver about you. And I like that you're Oliver on this show.
That was another big trap for me. I was like, oh, Oliver, well, clearly, Aaron wrote this for me. And yeah, I'm sure I was like the eighth person that they went to in a panic, because I later learned that the brilliant John Larroquette just sort of took a very sudden powder, apparently. And anyway, lucky for me, at the end of the day, yeah, he was, that's the guy who thought, oh, Oliver, yes, well, clearly this is destiny. But I think it was just Aaron being smart, you know?
But does that change your approach to the character? You know, if you did feel like it was written for you, do you feel like you made different choices as an actor than you would have maybe if it hadn't been named, character hadn't been named Oliver?
No, honestly, not really. I mean, Aaron was very good at names, right, for his characters, regardless who's playing them. The character was very much, in a weird way, could have been named Oliver, and especially Oliver Babish, you know. But no, I mean, the guide for me is the text, it's the word, it's the character. And the only thing that I give myself credit for understanding, aside from the fact that it was just a great role, but was that in the culture of this show, the secret of the show, in a weird way, was this wonderful sort of voyeuristic wish fulfillment, in the sense that there you had this extraordinary man who was the president of the United States, surrounded by these extraordinary people who were all deeply loyal to him and treated him like the sort of, you know, great man that he was. And along comes this guy who's just like, he clearly is very loyal to the president, but he's more like he practices tough love. You know, he's the son of a bitch. And also, the various directors are like egging me on to go in that direction. And it was, you know, it was really fun.
You have kind of major set piece scenes in these first three episodes. Your first appearance, you have this great back and forth with the president and Leo. In the second one, you have CJ, the confrontation with CJ at the beginning at 5:30 in the morning. And then in the third episode, really, it's between Oliver and Abigail, when you kind of take apart her entire argument.
Was the president's physician, have you ever asked him if he's ever had any extramarital affairs?
No.
Isn't that a crucial question in the diagnosing of autoimmune diseases?
I'd like to be next to my husband when he does this.
I'd like you to get your own lawyer.
Which is an interesting reversal from when CJ comes in and she says, do I need a lawyer? And the response is, no, I am the White House's lawyer. But I was wondering if, of those three episodes and those three big scenes, did one stand out as being more challenging than the others, or just harder to find?
The first set of scenes was more challenging simply because I was sleepless. If you knew how tired I was and how many takes it was taking me to get those sort of scenes the way they were written, you would, we were there a long time. But also, like anything, I just sort of skimmed these scenes in preparation for talking to you guys today. And, you know, as is always the case, I sort of saw myself settling in a little bit. You know, and again, actors, we always do this, and especially the sort of the older you get and you look at stuff that you did when you were younger. Invariably, right, for me, if there's any headline, is it's, oh, I wish I did a little less. But even just sort of watching the trajectory of how settling into that part, you saw me just get a little bit more comfortable. But I can't remember anyone. I mean, again, it's like when they're great scenes, it's never difficult. It's just fun. For me, in a weird way, when I think about the experience, the heart of the great scenes, believe it or not, for me, are the ones that are to come with Abby. There's some wonderful scenes in the end of the second season there, but some of those scenes with Abby in the beginning of the third season, that sort of, to me, is actually the heart of the story, is those scenes with Abby.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it's a very good question. But again, Allison is an old pal. It's so much fun, like, sort of going after each other. And, you know, again, that was sort of the great thing about being on a show where everyone's sort of firing on all cylinders on every level of the sort of creative team. There's all this help. You sort of have more fun work, which it usually manifests itself in sort of working harder or somehow working better. Speaking to this sort of like hard ass aspect of Babish, I have this particular memory of that. I think it's the last scene of the first episode when I show up in Marty's office.
The new slogan around here is going to be "Bring It On." He's going to have access to every piece of paper you ever touched. If you invoke executive privilege one time, I'm gone. An assistant DA in Duxworth wants to take your deposition, you're on the next plane. A freshman congressman wants your testimony, you'll sit in his kitchen. They want to drag you to The Hague and charge you with war crimes. What do we say?
Bring it on.
I remember we were blocking it, and Martin came in, and I was standing there, and then Martin sat down. I can't remember, I think it was Bill Johnson who directed that. He said, so,
that's right. Rabbi,
do you want to... Yeah. Sit down too. And I said, look, how about if I don't? What if I don't sit down? And because again, it was sort of seemed more, a little bit more imperious and more sort of like not so doing whatever the president did. And there was actually this, the rehearsal stopped and I think that literally calls were made. You know, what if Oliver doesn't sit down? Literally golf carts came screaming in to the stage and there was this conference and then they came and said, hey, guess what? Don't sit down. Don't sit down. We want you to not sit down.
Blocking emergency.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, I won't sit down. But that's what made me feel like, oh, this is really, it sort of confirmed this idea that, you know, this was a really interesting character to play in the culture of the show.
You said that that first scene took a lot of takes because you were so tired. How many takes did it take to get the smashing of the tape recorder down?
Like, what a great moment.
Luckily enough, you know, that we isolated because they probably only had so many tape recorders that they wanted to destroy. And as I recall, funnily enough, I think we got that in very few takes, if not one. And if you think about how frustrated I probably was at that time, you could imagine that I was going to fucking pulverize that tape recorder on the first go. But don't get me wrong, I was having a ball. I mean, despite how sort of humbling it was and sort of like, again, everybody was so nice. I was working with my friends. And again, John and Martin were just so delightful and so supportive because I think they'd probably, maybe not to that degree, but they'd seen other visitors to the show go through the same thing.
You know? Sure. It makes me chuckle a little bit at the fact that CJ has to say to Babish, "I don't know you," twice, when in fact that's somebody who you were good friends with.
Right. I just learned so much. I learned so much about the law. I just learned so much about that kind of law. I also learned so much about the White House. And again, it was a great, great story. And one of the things that was, aside from being a fascinating story legally, it was clearly such a trauma that was visited upon this group of people, right? This extraordinarily loyal, tight-knit, you know, group of people who had learned that their hero had kept something crucial from them. That big meeting in the basement after the polling, you know, and again, that extraordinary scene in the airport with Bradley and Marley Matlin, and that amazing scene where Charlie figures out, you know, finds like the smoking gun, the school forms that Abby signed, mm-hmm. and it's clearly an emergency, but that's classic Aaron Sorkin. It's like, okay, something bad happened.
Right.
We don't know what it is until, you know, three or four scenes later, exactly.
Was there ever any time in this process for you to get any background or research or talk to anyone else on the staff or the writing staff or any of the consultants, or was it you were just really thrown in?
I was thrown in, and I always ask a lot of questions, but again, the writing is so good. And look, you get to read the whole script, right? And so you know if indeed it's Aaron is doing something structurally where he's sort of planting a question to which is not going to be answered for a while. You've read the answer, actually. And again, there's so many people around, you know, anytime you had a question, like some freaking, you know, Lawrence O'Donnell come down from the writer's room or something like that, you know, so there's a lot of experts around.
The real deal, yeah.
Yeah, totally the real deal.
Awesome. And that's it for this episode of the West Wing Weekly. Thank you for listening.
And we hope to join us next time. Next time is going to be a little bit different. Our next episode is the season 2 finale of The West Wing. And it is a big one, as a lot of you guys already know. Two Cathedrals is a huge one. It's a lot of people's favorite episode of the series. And we felt like there was a chance we might not be able to do it justice with one episode. There was just too much to talk about. So in the first of our two parts on Two Cathedrals, we're going to be talking to Lawrence O'Donnell, both about his role in the show as an actor, as well as a writer and producer. And then we're going to follow that up the week after with some more on Two Cathedrals. So tune in next week for that.
Okay, in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Josh Molina. Rishi is at Rishi Hirway. Oliver Platt is at Oliver Platt. The show is at West Wing Weekly.
And if you want to discuss this episode with us or other West Wing Weekly listeners, you can leave a comment on our website, thewestwingweekly.com, or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thewestwingweekly. We're also on Instagram, where we post fun pictures for all you tweens.
It's worth noting that The West Wing Weekly is part of Radiotopia.
From PRX, a curated network of extraordinary, cutting-edge podcasts.
In the meantime, you can also listen to Rishi's other fantastic Radiotopia podcast, Song Exploder, and you can see me on Scandal Thursday nights on ABC at 9, 8 Central. And you can buy all sorts of merchandise at westwingweekly.com/merch.
Get a shirt and then wear it to Radiotopia Live so we can give you the signal when we see you.
That's right.
Or a pin.
Goodbye.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
If you're looking for another podcast to listen to, check out Normal Gossip from Radiotopia. They're coming back for their 6th season. If you don't already know the show, they were named one of the best podcasts of the year by Time Magazine and Vulture, and their new season starts April 17th. Normal Gossip is really fun. It's a show about petty and ridiculous and strange stories and the way that we share those stories. The stories that they tell in the podcast are sent in by listeners, and then they're anonymized and then retold to a guest. And then they have to weigh in on the decisions that the people in the story are making. It's very funny and very beloved. So if you aren't already listening, check out the new season, which starts April 17th. You can listen to Normal Gossip wherever you get your podcasts.
Radiotopia.